Welcome to Personal Landscapes. I'm your host, Brian Murdoch. You can find links for today's episode and other conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdoch.com. The oldest surviving stories from the human past deal with the relationship between settled people and nomads. They're often tales of conflict, written by urban dwellers who lived behind high walls. But there's another untold side of the human story, one whose tracks crisscross the natural world. Nomads acted as catalysts and creators, and prime agents of social renewal. Why have they gotten such a bad rap throughout history? And why is their knowledge essential for us today? That's the topic of today's podcast. I'm joined by Anthony Satin, author of Nomads, The Wanderers Who Shaped Our World. It's a fascinating read, and it'll change the way you look at the collective past. We spoke about nomadic empires, cycles of history, pastoral peoples, and how steppe nomads contributed to the European Renaissance. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. So I found it interesting that our oldest stories deal with the relationship between settled people and nomads, like from the earliest stories that come down to us to the foundational stories of our own Western culture. There seemed to be something very fundamental about stories of movement in our past.
Yeah, and for lots of really, really sound reasons, the most pressing one being that about 12,000 years ago, we were all living life on the move. And our foundational stories all relate to, you know, a time in the past, the golden age, the time of giants, when the gods walked on earth or whatever it was. And therefore it relates mostly to a period when we all lived on the move. And in all cultures, there isn't one on earth that doesn't have some foundation myth that involves movement and people who live on the move.
But that being said, there's differences between these stories. Like the Egyptian worship of nomadic Seth or Set points to a more nuanced view compared to the kind of good-evil duality that branded Cain an outcast. And you see the same thing in the Mesopotamian story of Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh kind of needed the wild man Enkidu to sort of keep him in check. Could you speak a bit about that this difference in how they saw settled and nomadic peoples, or how settled people saw nomadic peoples?
Yes, I think, it's important to remember that those stories are all recorded, if not originated, by settled people. And this is obviously one of the problems we have when talking about people who live on the move, that mostly they haven't written their own stories, because nomadic cultures tend to prefer, definitely favor oral tradition rather than putting things down. Libraries are not a nomadic thing. In general, but it's interesting. I mean, particularly the story of the ancient Egyptians of the god Seth, who is the brother of the god Osiris, and Osiris is credited as the god who teaches the Egyptians how to be Egyptian, how to live on the land, how to farm, how to be civilized in that sense. And his brother is given, the other half of the land, which is desert, and therefore he's the god of the wilderness, of chaos, because everything outside the valley for ancient Egyptians was a land of chaos, and this, down the ages becomes equated with evil, and Seth is somebody who does, who does stir up a lot of trouble. The absolutely sort of core myth of the Egyptian gods is that Seth kills his brother, but Osiris doesn't die because he's a god and he becomes the lord of the underworld. But what becomes really interesting is that you'd imagine, therefore, if this was a sort of clear-cut black and white case, that you'd have you'd have Seth therefore either being killed or being destroyed or being in some way curtailed, but he's not in the Egyptian myths. He's absolutely central and necessary, and I think from the Romans onwards we have this idea of the need to defeat evil, and therefore to defeat the other, whatever that might be. It might not be evil, it might just not be you and me, it might be whatever lies beyond the frontier. But for the ancient Egyptians, it was important that you can't have, in a way, good without evil. You can't have order without chaos, and therefore you can never destroy it.
So are there parallels between the idea of like Satan as the light bringer?
Yes, exactly. And so Seth is, there's this brilliant sculpture. First time I saw it, after I'd been looking into Seth, because I'd always accepted this idea that Seth was you know, was evil, bad, had to be destroyed. And the later version of the story, which is from the Roman period, he is killed. The god is killed by Osiris's son Horus revenges him. They have this epic battle that goes on for 32 years or 320 years or whatever it is. And, you know, at one point, Seth pulls out Horus's eye, which becomes this sort of famous protective amulet. You still see it all over the place today, the Eye of Horus. But Horus defeats his evil uncle and kills him in the later version. But in the earlier version, he doesn't, because you need Seth, and you need Seth for two things. And there's a brilliant sculpture of the last of the sort of the really important empire period pharaohs. This is the end of the New Kingdom, about 1000 BC. Ramses III standing with the god Osiris with a hand on one shoulder and Seth with a hand on the other. You can't be a complete king without the blessing of both, is the suggestion of this image, which I find absolutely fascinating. And also, when you're on your way to the afterlife, the pharaoh, you go on a boat through the heavens at night, and on the boat are all the gods, and including Seth. And there's this really fearsome three-headed winged snake that's going to come and eat you up. And it has the power of drying up the waters of the celestial river and putting all the gods to sleep except for Seth. So even in this sort of, you know, triumphant afterlife moment, you still need the counterpoint. And of course, you do need the counterpoint. I mean, you mentioned Gilgamesh and Enkidu, this sort of really ancient story. It goes back, you know, into the early days of Mesopotamia. We can't quite know how far back it goes, because it's clearly from a pre-literate period. And it reflects the problems of settlement. So on the one hand, you have Gilgamesh, who's the king of this famous city, Uruk, which with its high walls. And I wonder in my book, Nomads, whether the walls are there to keep the evil out or to keep the people in. Because you've got the first problems of appearing in settled society. And that is, you've got a rubbish ruler called Gilgamesh, who terrorizes his people. And famously, in an echo of a recent American president, insists on being able to sleep with the brides before the bridegroom and that sort of stuff. And so the people pray, because they can't get out of the city. So they pray to the gods to send a counterpoint to Gilgamesh. And so the gods send Enkidu, who impersonates the power of the natural world. He's hairy. He's naked. He runs with the animals. He's fast, and the animals accept him. So he is a wild animal at this stage. And when Gilgamesh hears about Enkidu, he doesn't go out and fight him, because I think he suspects that he might lose. Instead, he sends a woman who's described in the text as a temple priestess who is clearly also a prostitute, and she undresses at the watering hole, and Enkidu comes running down and sees her, and then has an inner sort of very clear echo of Adam and Eve, has sex with her, and then he can't run with the animals. The natural world is no longer his. He has this knowledge that stops him being able to live the way he lived before. So he has to go into the city. Mm-hmm. And this is clearly a sort of a meditation on the human story, on the time when we all lived on the move and then we move into the city. But one of the consequences that come out of this, which leads to a sort of tragic ending for Enkidu, is that Gilgamesh leads him on this sort of epic expedition, which Enkidu says should not be done, and that is to cut down the cedar forest and kill the bull of heaven, and both of which Gilgamesh and Enkidu achieve. But the punishment exacted by the gods is that Enkidu, the natural, forceful side of the human duality, in a way, is killed. He dies. And there's a sort of sense of the death of our ability to be in the natural world, and also a reflection of the damage that we're doing to the natural world, because they've just chopped down this big forest. I mean, this is an early sort of Extinction Rebellion protest is about to come around. And I make these parallels with our time, because these stories are so vibrant and so relevant to today, it seems to me.
Is there also a sense that in order to take Enkidu's wisdom, they have to assimilate him? they can't kind of meet him, you know, outside on the walls, so to speak, but they have to bring him into the culture. And in so doing, they tame him and perhaps destroy what he had to contribute.
Yes, there's very much a sense of needing to tame him. But I think he has to be tamed in order to come into the walls. I mean, that's the deal. And there's a very interesting process where he realizes, after he's had this sort of epic sexual encounter with the temple woman, that he's prepared for the city by being by going to a hunter's camp where he's shaved, where he's taught how to enjoy bread and beer, drinks a huge amount, gets drunk, and basically is therefore taught how to be literally a citizen, somebody who lives in the city. And it's not the same as, and therefore somebody who's going to live in one place and enjoy the fruits, which is bread and beer, of the agricultural community.
So let's backtrack for 1 second and establish a quick definition of nomads. You say the root word for nomad once meant something like a member of a wandering pastoral tribe, implying someone looking for pasture, but that this changed after towns and cities were built. How so?
Yes, well, it's the word is very, very, very old Indo-European, and it nomas, and it refers to either the right to pasture or a land where you can pasture, and therefore it implies that you have animals that you need to feed, and therefore out of that comes this word which is nomad, which in its purest sense refers to somebody who has animals that need to be taken around for pasture. And therefore that's not, I'm sitting in England at the moment. We don't have this tradition because we have agriculture, and therefore we bring our animals feed most of the time. And if we take them outside, they're just left to wander around on grassy land. But mostly these people, most nomads in history, are living for most of the time in land which is only very seasonally suitable. So, for instance, I write in my book Nomads about, it opens with a visit to the Bakhtiari tribe in Iran, and I chose them because they claim that this tradition that they have, the way they live, goes back to the dawn of time, and maybe thousands of years, but also that there's this wonderful film that was made about them 100 years ago. So at least I can absolutely certainly say that that what they're doing now is what they were doing more or less 100 years ago. And they winter on the Mesopotamian plain, on land that is now divided between Iraq and Iran. They're on the Iranian side of that plain, where the winters are mild, and because of the Tigris and Euphrates River and the rainfall that washes over them, you have winter grasses. But when the summer comes or the spring comes, it all gets burnt up. So there's no feed for their animals. So they take them up into the Zagros Mountains. And during the winter, the Zagros Mountains are under heavy, heavy snow. I can't remember how high up they are. But anyway, it's quite a height. But come the late spring, May, all the snow is melted, and you've got these beautiful wildflower valleys, and that's where they're going to stay literally until the ground freezes under their feet, and then they go down again. Mm-hmm. And so it's that sort of land which it isn't good for agriculture that nomads have traditionally pastured. And then Mesopotamia is interesting because we know from ancient Sumerian records, so this is 2500 BC, that the farmers on the Mesopotamian plain needed these herders to come after the harvest and eat the stubble. Not just to eat the stubble, because there are animals then left droppings which fertilize the land. And so there was this very, for most of history, this very happy, mutually dependent relationship between farmers and herders.
It's very interesting because it implies not sort of just this aimless wandering rootlessness, but a circuit around particular known places, just a sort of life on the move, but within a contained boundary. Like, it's very different from the way nomads are characterized today. You say in the book that the connotations for nomad are rootlessness. Such people are drifters, migrants, vagrants, people on the go, on the run, of no fixed abode. They're people who are not known. It's a very different conception, sort of a shameful kind of conception and a threatening one.
Always with that connotation of you don't know them, and therefore because they're not fixed to one place, although as you point out, they're very often fixed to two places, and they do move between two specific areas. And it's the same, for instance, in Arabia with the Bedouin, where they would move into the desert when it gets cooler in the winter, and then there's winter grazing, and then they'll move out into the edge of the desert in the summer because it's too hot, everything is burnt out inside. But they're still generally moving between lands that would be recognized, although maybe not officially owned by them, and that's theirs. And then you get tribal conflicts when you get warming, or when you get this cycle we're going through at the moment of global warming is not new. And when you get a particularly warm period, then there's less grazing in the hot season. And then you get conflict between the different tribes. But there's coming back to ancient Sumer, there's a story from about 2500 BC, called the story of Martu, where a Sumerian princess wants to marry this nomad. And her friends are all saying, but you're mad. I mean, you can't. I mean, he doesn't know how to worship the gods properly. He wears leather. He eats raw meat. And above all, that he's not known. And when he dies, he won't be buried in a tomb. His body will just go somewhere. How can you? And of course, she turns around and says, I'm going to marry him anyway.
So the first section of the book deals with a lot of these old stories and a time when settled and nomadic peoples lived side by side and collaborated, as you just said, with the farmers relying on the pastoralists to eat the stubble from the fields and leave the droppings for fertilizer. Why did early settled people end up feeling threatened by the mobile world beyond their walls when it was a world they so recently inhabited? Is it because in times of scarcity, they were competing for the same resources?
I think it's very much that. And also, there was an element of, well, yes, it's two things. I mean, on the one hand, very definitely a sense of competition. And as we've already mentioned, that sense of not being known, of being anxious about them. When somebody comes out of a community that lives behind walls, you know where to find them, you know where they are, you know where they should be. And here are people who sort of, maybe don't drift aimlessly, but who do move. And the balance, that social balance, it seems to be so fragile, the urban social balance. And there's also a sense of, well, there's a natural power. And, I mentioned this in the middle section of the book, and maybe I'm jumping forward a bit, about Ibn Khaldun, this great Arab philosopher, who talks about the raw power of nomadic people that settled people can't manage, because life as a nomad, particularly if you're living somewhere like the edge of a desert or the interior of a desert, it's very hard, and you're going to come out a tough person, and therefore on a simple confrontational level, your city raised military might not be up to facing nomad army. There's that very, very clear sense. And also, we don't know how do we know which rules they're playing by? How do we know? I mean, so that again, that sense of not being known, and not literally we don't know who they are, but we don't know what they stand for. We don't know where they've come. We don't know what it'll take to make them go away. And of course, it's curious because, I mean, most of the records we have about nomads into history and deep history, very ancient history, are from settled people, and therefore they're biased, and they're generally only referred to times of conflict, and which is a minority of the time, because for most of the time there's a very happy mutual dependence. I mean, nomads have things they need to sell. Whether it's their animals that when they're, when they've reached the right age and the right fatness need to be, and before they're going to go on this huge trek, you want to thin out your flock, and therefore you want to sell them. And therefore you need a market. And at the same time, there are things you don't produce as a nomad that you need to buy from settled people. And you want to sell them your wool and whatever, and leathers and horses and whatever else. And therefore, there is that sense of there being a need on both sides to have an exchange, at least a commercial exchange. And that That's true for most of history. But you look in the records and it's very hard to find because that doesn't make a good story. You know, it's the everyday, but it doesn't make a good story. And then so for instance, in China, this is ancient China, so sort of 400, 200 BC up to about 200 and 400 AD, the Han Chinese emperor is having trouble with the nomads up on the northwest border. This is why the Chinese built the Great Wall, to try and keep the nomads out. But of course, we know that walls don't work. I mean, you just either go through them or around them or over them. But if you're determined to get around a wall, you do. And what is clear from the Chinese records, and particularly this wonderful source called the Grand Historian of China, is that most of the time, the connection was very happy because the Chinese emperor agreed to trading posts. And the Chinese wanted the horses that were being raised up on the steps because they were finer horses than the Chinese could breed down on the plains, and so you have this very happy connection between the two. And that, as I say, is a story for most of history between the settled and nomadic people.
That's interesting. I suppose it's a happy connection because it's controlled. They feel like they're in control of where the trading takes place. Maybe when you say this is these sorts of interactions are less interesting story because they don't involve such conflict, but clearly your book proves otherwise. I mean, this is what was so interesting about it, the contributions of nomadic societies to our own culture, the things that we miss or take for granted. But before going that far ahead, I wanted to ask about the second section of your book, which deals with large-scale organizational structures created by nomads, in many cases nomadic empires. And you touched on the Mongols there briefly and that threatened China. So why was the Great Eurasian Steppe so conducive to mobility?
Well, it's a vast, vast area, 6,000 miles or whatever. It goes from the edge of Europe, from the Great Hungarian Plain, the whole way to Manchuria, to China, with the Altai Mountains sitting in the middle. And the western half, therefore, west of the Altai, is relatively lowland and grassy steppes. And the other side is much higher and also still grassy, but more difficult, much, much hotter in the summer and much colder in the winter. This is Mongolia, the Mongolian plateau, for instance. And, so it's not good for agriculture. So in terms of settled cities, it doesn't make sense because settled cities need food sources nearby, which means you need farmland nearby. And just to point out that the majority of our planet is not conducive to agriculture. The majority of the land on our planet is much more suited to herding and therefore to nomads.
These plains would just be a vast area of resources. I mean, it's a food on the hoof for these nomads. They can range across this freely while getting everything they need to fuel their mobility, from grass for the horses to water to, I mean, especially considering somebody like the Mongols who live so much in the summer off white foods and the fruits of their horses and sheep.
Yes, exactly. And it's very, I mean, the Eurasian steppe is very good for horses. This is probably where horses came from. It's certainly where they were first domesticated, up on the Pontic Caspian steppe, above the Caspian Sea. And horses are very good on the steppes because it does freeze in the winter, but with their hoofs, they can scratch through the ice and find the grasses underneath. So they're not going to, I mean, unless it's an exceptionally bad winter, they're not going to starve. So you have an animal that's really, really suited to herding there. And yes, mare's milk, and traditionally the nomads would, and particularly Mongolian nomads, would drink and ferment it as well. So for their celebrations and their religious ceremonies, they would get absolutely off their heads on fermented mare's milk.
That's a foul liquid, isn't it? Have you had that?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yes, I have.
I was traveling in Mongolia years ago, 20 years ago or something, and got into a mess of vodka with the driver of my Jeep, and we woke up the next morning with catastrophic hangovers, and he just pointed at the first gare that he saw and said, you know, this mare's milk is good for the hangover. And I remember I being handed a wooden bowl and there's fat and hair floating in it and choking this down. I looked up at the man across from me, like these tough looking herders were sitting across from us, and he was wearing a ball cap that said in English, "Do I make you horny?" I'm thinking, can this get any worse?
And you drank it and it did.
No, it got better actually. I felt much better after drinking that. So
did it. Okay.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that Mongol wisdom.
No. I don't stomach that. And neither that nor yak butter. Well, we're telling
you. Oh, yak butter. Yeah. I don't mind the
old
tea.
Yak butter. 25-year-old yak butter. I got
that's considered aged. I think a delicacy of some kind.
Apparently, it was an honor. But horses which roamed, naturally roamed the Eurasian steppe, are perfectly suited to that environment. And so, first of all, people started herding them, and then worked out that you could ride them, and then the world was transformed. I mean, that's the most successful form of communication apart from our own feet has been the development of our ability to ride a horse, which, until 100 years ago, most of us knew how to do and didn't think it was some sort of class snobby thing that you go and ride. It's just like, that's how you got around. So you have the beginning of this ability to gather people and to move significant distances across the steppes. And so the Eurasian steppe was brilliant for herding initially, but also for gathering people together who could, control the world. I mean, as they did, the largest empires the world had ever known were first one was created by Genghis Khan, and the second by Timur, in 1400 of our own era. And and these empires were enormous the whole way from China to Europe, and they were well connected and brilliantly conceived. I mean, because these are people who understood about movement and travel and what you need on the way. Famously, the Mongol Empire had its. We know about Roman roads, and some of us know about the Persian Royal Road. Well, the Mongols just took it a whole step further and went a lot further, but had the same idea of a post house where you get fresh horses, where you get fed and watered and whatever yourself, and there's this sort of this coin system that I write about. If you had the wooden one, you got a basic, you got somewhere, a corner to lie down in, and you got some basic food. And if you had the fancy gold coin, then you got silk sheets and you got a banquet, and you probably got to sleep with the innkeeper's daughter or wife or whatever else as well. You got full service.
You mentioned that most of the accounts we have of such people come from the settled people who came into conflict with them, but we also have we're fortunate to have these burials. So what did nomad burials tell us about these early steppe cultures?
Yes, I the archaeology is such an interesting part of this story, because it's changing all the time. There was in London about 7 years ago, the British Museum had an exhibition on the Scythians.
I saw this. Yeah, that was fantastic.
It was fantastic. But when it was announced, almost everybody I know said, "Scythians? The hell are the Scythians? And why would the British Museum want to have an exhibition about them?" And of course, you go along and you think, the Scythians. All right. So I have a suggestion, which nobody has disproved yet, that at the time of the Roman Empire, the great Roman Empire, control of the Mediterranean world, and the Han Chinese Empire, this vast empire of the Yellow River and, all of what's now present-day China. But between the two, you have a much larger area that is nomad land. And in the east, they're called the Xiongnu. And in the west, they're called the Scythians. And they have great similarities. And we know they're not called the Xiongnu. We don't know what they call themselves. We know they didn't call themselves the Xiongnu because it translates as illegitimate offspring of slaves. And I don't know anybody who would willingly choose to call themselves that. And we don't know what the Scythians call themselves. So I mentioned the British Museum exhibition because there was a 3-day conference around that exhibition of the world's great Scythian experts that I went to. And one of the questions at the end was, so we call them Scythians, but what did they call themselves? And there's like sort of long, awkward silence. Nobody knows. No, we don't know what they call. We don't even know what they called themselves. But what we do know, so that my suggestion is that the Scythians and the Xiongnu are actually the same people. And if they're not the same people, they are people who with the same habits and the same beliefs and the same way of life, and who worked in an alliance together. This is, for instance, how one way that Chinese silks ended up in Rome, that they were being traded across this vast, you know, later on we talk about the Silk Roads, but there's no reason why they weren't already in existence in the time of the Roman Empire. And that this huge nomadic alliance, let's say, if we're not going to call it an empire, between the Xiongnu and the Scythians and the Sogdians and the Sarmatians and all the other tribes, will have joined up East and West and become the middlemen. I find that entirely convincing and possible. And the one of the reasons I'm convinced by it is because of the archaeology. And whether you're looking east or west, whether you're looking at Xiongnu burials or Scythian burials up in Siberia or down near the Caspian Sea, you find the same things. You find these huge burial mounds, some of them, you know, 50, 100 meters around and more. And mostly using the same technique, which is there's this passage into the inside. Very often you've got a stone area to mark the outside circle and therefore the edge of what's a sacred space. You've very often got horse sacrifices, so horse heads or entire horses are buried with them. And sometimes you have several burials inside, but there's always going to be at least one high status, as they're called. And these are people who are being buried, as I say, east and west, north and south, with the same things, with Chinese silks, with gold jewelry that has originated, at least in design, in the Byzantine Roman world, with Persian carpets, with, you know, they're all using the same gear. And so even if they're not the same people, they certainly have this, you know, they're being buried in the same way. There's obviously a limit to how much you can unify them, because the texts are not there, annoyingly. But I find it very convincing. And on the east side, you have this historical source, the grand historian of China. And in the west, you have Herodotus, the father of history, as he's called. And they both say exactly the same things about the people, the way they look, the way and their customs and manners. And I think it's extraordinary. We know so much about the Roman world and so much about Han China. Imagine if there was an even greater empire that sat between the two. I mean, that sort of thing really excites me.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And even if they weren't directly connected culturally, it's certainly the lifestyle, the environment, the way that they lived would dictate a very similar lifestyle. They're inhabiting the same sorts of geography. And they're so mobile. I mean, how could they not be? Constant interconnections between these people. You see it even in the Uyghurs and the Mongols, like the ruins of Uyghur civilizations in Mongolia today. What's Mongolia today? And a Uyghur script on the Mongol money, even as of 20 years ago, I don't know now, but the interconnections between those peoples and the connections between the Turkic languages of the Uyghurs and what would become the Turkish people so suggests so much interconnection and mobility in these areas.
And if there's a connection and a passing on, an exchange of physical things, then there must be an exchange of ideas, of beliefs, and maybe this is how, you know, because we know later on at the time of the Mongol empires we were talking about, Genghis Khan, Timur, that a huge number of things come to the West via these nomadic societies, and most famously gunpowder, paper and the compass, but lots of other things come as well. In England we have the Order of the Garter, and you know that this is inspired by the Mongols. We have, you know, there's so much that when you start digging into it, it was Mongol inspired in Europe, and so therefore it must have been like that, you know, 1,000 years earlier or 1,500 years earlier in the ancient world as well.
So you said that these steppe nomad cultures are characterized by several things: this the horse, the chariot, the composite bow, asabia, and a love of stories, especially epic histories and sagas. But first of all, asabia, for people who don't understand, what is this?
We don't know what it would have been called in antiquity. That this is an Arabic word, and it implies a sort of group feeling. It's what happens when you have a charismatic leader who can gather together usually sort of quite homogenous, but can be culturally diverse group of people behind an idea. It could just be himself, you know, we've seen that in cults in our own time, you know, sort of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, for instance, or someone like that. It's a word that this Arab philosopher I mentioned, Ibn Khaldun, uses a lot. And he refers to the Prophet Muhammad, for instance, using being able to summon this asabiyya, this idea of a group feeling, behind the idea that the Archangel Gabriel had revealed the will of God to him. You know, think about it. This is somebody who's in 7th century Arabia, gathering together all sorts of diverse peoples, from people who had been Jewish and Christian to animists and others around this single idea, and motivating them because they're united by this idea, and motivating them to do something which was well beyond their expectations before they were formed by asabiyya.
I suppose too, undertaking such a thing together, whether it's an epic journey like this or spreading these ideas, would also further cement this bond between this small group that's traveling together, in the same way that anybody who endures hardships when traveling on some sort of difficult trip has that something that can never be taken away afterwards, because you've relied on each other, you know?
Yeah, well, it's exactly that. I mean, if you've been on a long journey together, particularly if it's a sort of a relatively isolated one, you know, across a desert or the steppes or whatever, even today, then, you know, at the end of those weeks or months or whatever, you and the people you're traveling with are going to feel that you have a special bond. That's exactly it.
And also to come back to this love of stories and epic histories and sagas, you had something really interesting here. You said that the way they passed on wisdom was very different, how nomads preferred stories that could be told and retold and perhaps reinterpreted across the ages, whereas settled peoples quickly evolved elaborate written codes and laws to regulate people's behavior and to describe how life should be lived within walls and borders. I thought that's really interesting, the idea that these oral histories and oral traditions aren't just repeated to preserve the story, but they can be reinterpreted to suit, you know, different times and different, whereas these written down stories often solidify into a dogma or something controlling.
Yeah, while you're mentioning that, I was thinking about, because I've been thinking about Syria recently, and I was remembering watching a Hakawati, who's a traditional storyteller, in a cafe in Damascus about 2006 or something. And, you know, he's a man who's sitting on a chair on a table, because it's a crowded cafe and he wants to be seen. And he has a metal top table beside him that and a sword on it, and he slams a sword onto the table when he's ready to talk. And it could, you know, he could have been sitting there for an hour just gathering his thoughts. And what he's going to do, what he did was tell a story that everybody knew. You know, it you know, it'd be like sort of, you know, I don't tell it, telling Romeo and Juliet again. But so it's not, and everybody knows how it's going to end. I mean, everybody knows the narrative arc, but he's going to add things to it, and the things he adds, and this was particularly relevant at this time because it was the time of, you know, Assad Syria, when nobody was free to talk, and he would weave into this story things that were sort of coded messages. It was a reflection on what was something that had just happened in the city, or if there's I mean, I remember also watching Coriolanus in Damascus, and obviously censor had not realized that it was about a bloody dictator. But you know, so there's that element of the story, and it's also a sense of, I mean, for nomads it was an important part of the buy-in for men, this idea of, you know, the half the idea of chivalry and of knighthood, and a lot of what came back from the Crusades had originally come, you know, that those codes had come off the nomadic steppes, was that, you know, you're going to be a band of brothers, you're going to fight together, you're going to look after each other, you're going to die, and when after you've died, you'll be remembered. People will tell your story, and, you know, and you know, that certainty was an important, well, that was the reward, glory rather than a long life was what you were settling for. But I mean, I would say that, you know, written stories also get shaped and reshaped. I mean, I think we're living through such an interesting period of history ourselves right now, where you know, well, there was, you know, Orientalism and then post-Orientalism and now decolonization and now post-decolonization. And, you know, and obviously the whole gender thing is coming now in. So there's been a lot of feminist writing looking back in history and prehistory. I think it's so interesting because, yeah, because that it when you look back, you think, God, these texts just go on and on and on, and there's a canon of work that can't be touched. But actually, I think just today, just now, there's nothing that can't be touched, and therefore, writing history is really exciting.
Yeah, there's much to re-examine and many different angles to look at some of these stories. Yeah, yeah,
that's right. Well, that, and you know, and Nomads was my attempt to do just that. You know, to say, I mean, I quote the Oxford and Princeton historian Felipe, I can never get his name right. Anyway, who described history as a path picked through ruins, and you know, my argument was, well, if that's really how history is, then the only role for nomads in that vision is of people who destroy, because they don't build monuments, and therefore, if history is about the ruins, then the only role for nomads in that version of history is as the people who creator of ruins. Although he did go on later to say, but the most successful culture there's ever been is the hunter-gatherer one. I mean, everything else has come and gone, but hunter-gatherers and herders are still doing what they've always done.
Yeah, very interesting. You said nomad empires also gave prominence to free trade and the free movement of ideas, which is something we see today as well.
Yes, that wasn't something I was expecting. I mean, it wasn't something I knew before I started researching this book, and I was so struck by there's early market capitalism there, when Kublai Khan goes into the imperial treasury and sees all this gold and silver lying around, saying, "What's this? Why are we storing this stuff? Like, give it to people and, you know, have them do things with it, and we'll all get richer." You know, which is like the banks sort of lending out money or handing out money.
Yeah, that was a great story, a great example too, and why it's foolish to sit on your little hoard yourself as well. I mean, there's a lesson in that for all of us. This is supposed to generate more for everybody and spread around. And by spreading it around, then you generate these experiences and maybe these legendary stories that you live on through or whatever, as well as economic gain for everybody else. I mean,
we're all going to give it away.
Now I'm just going to travel on all of it, whatever I can scrape together.
Yeah.
You've justified my need to travel.
Very good. But also, yes, I mean, it's clear that, that, you know, the trade barriers of the Mongol Empire were brought down. They didn't care. There was freedom of conscience. So they really didn't care if you were a Christian, a Muslim, an animist, a Buddhist, or whatever. It really didn't matter. And the taxation was really low because they wanted people to interact. They wanted movement. They wanted goods to go left and right, north and south. And with that comes, you know, the most extraordinary flourishing of culture. Most famously, of course, the European Renaissance.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about next. Actually, how did steppe nomads contributed to the European Renaissance? I mean, that's out of left field. I didn't expect that.
Yes, why don't we all know this? Why don't we all know this story? I mean, I don't think I could say, although I'd like to, that we wouldn't have a European Renaissance if it wasn't for the Mongol Renaissance first. But clearly, the Mongols create the circumstances and also provide Europeans with the tools with which to flourish culturally and intellectually, and politically and economically as well, because they're, you know, at the Elizabethan beginning of the 1600s AD, Francis Bacon, the philosopher, talks about these three things: gunpowder, the compass, and paper, being things that have come from the East and that the West uses to transform the world. And the, you know, paper is easy because, you know, you then get printing press being created in Europe, and then you have the dissemination of knowledge, but you also have knowledge being spread, but only spread to a certain, only to the right people, and therefore you have control of knowledge is power, and therefore you have control of power. And the compass being the thing that allows the great voyages of discovery, which partly are stimulated by the fact that going overland east, I mean, remember that when Columbus is going goes west across the Atlantic, he's or Vasco da Gama, they're looking for the sea route to India, you know, which is why, therefore, they call West Indies West Indies, because they thought they'd found India, but it wasn't. But because they couldn't going overland was so difficult because of the Mongols. And after, famously after Timur, the whole world, you know, all those, his great empire fractures into a whole series of empires and it becomes much more unstable. So the Europeans take to water. And the compass allows them to do that. And the third thing is gunpowder, which comes from China and had been used in religious ceremonies to scare away the evil spirits and obviously gets weaponized by the West and allows the great conquest. So you have these three things that have come, you know, overland across the steppes from China, brought by nomadic peoples into Europe, and Europeans use to dominate the world.
Yeah, you mentioned Ibn Khaldun before. He touches on this as well. He presents nomads not as barbarians riding in to destroy what had been created, but as prime movers and kingmakers. What did he mean by kingmakers?
His idea is that the purest of humans are the hardcore nomads who live in the desert. And he grades nomads. You know, there's this sort of the nomad of the nomad, who's the sort of in his experience, are the people who are herding camels in the desert. And camels need female camels need extremely hot weather in order to give birth in the desert. Apparently, it's one of the things he writes about. And so here are people who are sort of absolutely desert hardened, you know, fire hardened. And living in as close as possible to man's original state. And, you know, and then you have a gradation of people coming out of that, into, you know, the people who live on the edge, who are sort of part, you know, only they're part farmers, part herders. And then you've got people who in cities who are the most corrupt of all, because living in a city physically doesn't engage most people. And this thing that brings people together in the first place, Asabiya, cannot survive in the city because, I mean, as we see in our great cities today, you know, the sense of community, of a shared identity, breaks down behind, you know, when everybody lives behind walls, and particularly when in Ibn Khaldun's examples, when a leader. So he talks about how whatever empire you look at was started by people who had this initial great nomadic energy and were united by asabiya, by a group feeling, and they create an empire. They settle in a city, and very quickly the leader finds, the man who's started this whole thing, finds himself living behind walls and therefore separated from the people who he once lived, you know, sat down with every day, and then he no longer does. And so he loses touch, and he becomes weak, and the people around him become weak, and then they become vulnerable for the next great surge of nomadic energy to come out of the desert. And in Ibn Khaldun's own time, you know, he was living in first in Morocco and Tunisia. What is now Morocco and Tunisia, and there were constant waves, the Almohads and the Almoravids, and of different dynasties, and they were reformers that would come out of the desert, very often, you know, sort of quite scary, you know, religious people, who wanted to purify these corrupt city livers, and then they get into the city themselves, they get into the palaces, and they, you know, bit by bit sort of get corrupted, and therefore they become vulnerable to the next wave. And that's Ibn Khaldun's view of the rise and fall of kingdoms. And you look backwards beyond him into history and deep history, and you have to say, yeah, it's very much the case. You know, you have, I mean, you know, someone like Alexander the Great doesn't really work as an example, but you know, when you have somebody who sets up a really strong kingdom or empire, very often the children, or particularly the grandchildren, will not have that same force. And you know, he talks about the Arabs and Baghdad, and how, you know, these great Arab emperors are made vulnerable by the wealth and the sensuality that inevitably surrounds them in their palaces. There's a moral for us all there. We shouldn't live in palaces.
Well, yeah, there's interesting parallels too. This idea of nomads as catalysts and creators and kind of prime agents of social renewal. You say, I can't remember if this is a quote from Ibn Khaldun or if this is something I quoted from you. You say that nomads could create powerful new movements, but could not maintain them once they settled. It's a bit like founders of companies. Like, I had a small internet publishing business for several years, and at some point that sort of small startup has to transform itself into a more mature kind of traditional business to survive. And the person who had the initial brilliant idea took the risks and all of that is not normally the person who can do the tedious work of kind of creating systems and stabilizing things and allowing it to carry on as a structure. So this sort of an interesting idea of these nomads who come out of nowhere, start something new, and then you need a different type of person to carry that on.
Yes, you do. And carrying on that analogy, present day, with, you know, how many sort of great sort of you know, masters of the universe, heads of multinationals won't, you know, almost all of them will have some story that they'll wistfully trot out about how when they started they just, you know, and they knew everyone in the company and it was all so great, and now it's just, you know, you turn up to meetings and there are thousands of people sort of sitting behind everybody else and finding it so difficult to get a sense, as for instance we are told President Putin has a difficulty of getting a sense of what's really going on in the world. And yeah, it needs a different person to take things on.
And you also mentioned Ibn Khaldun's notion that things don't inevitably improve with the passage of time, that there's sort of, instead of there being an ascent of man, there's or even an upward and downward progression. He saw circularity in all things, like how power waxes and wanes and empires rise and collapse. It reminded me of the philosopher John Gray, whose books I really love. But he draws an interesting distinction. He says that technology progresses in a linear fashion, but there's no parallel in ethics or politics or philosophy or the arts. So, you know, humans are no more reasonable than we've ever been. So gains in civilization are lost over and over and over again.
Yes. I mean, I think you just have to look, you know, you look back through history and to say that, you know, the specifics, the details change, but the general trends do not. And are people better people now? Are they more fulfilled now? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But also because I think we are living in such an interesting moment in human development now, where, and this is something else I refer to in Nomads, where that whole world that was put in place by the Age of Reason, I mentioned Francis Bacon, and then the Age of Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution that come out of that, and we, the children of that whole game, have come to the end, you know, the end of that cycle. It's not so long ago that President Macron in France was talking about needing a new social contract. Well, we need more than a new social contract. I mean, you know, we need a new everything. And we're not quite sure where we're going to. We're not quite sure what's going to happen next. We're not quite sure who's going to come up with the idea that's going to save us. But we all have a sense that we need to be saved, this is not just a Western, you know, sort of Western decline idea. Wherever I've been in the world, I've heard the same anxiety being expressed. You know, where the hell are we going? And, you know, and whose idea is this? Because it's, you know, there's no longer a vision to it. And in Nomads, I point to this guy Bacon in 1600s, because he's so interesting in what he writes about what he believes is the mission of the human, and that is to reclaim the world that was lost by Adam and Eve, and to go, you know, and that is dominion over nature.
So is this a Christian notion? Did this originate with Christianity, this idea that God put everything here for our benefit and it's up to us to make it productive?
Well, no, the Mongols had it as well. I mean, Genghis Khan very much believed that it was his divine, it was written by the gods that he must control the world. And Timur was the same. And there are lots of people going back, but Bacon is just so good because he's so systematic in his explanation and in his arguments. You know, brilliant scholar. I think he was allowed into Cambridge at Cambridge University age 12, And, you know, and so this is his great work when he's, I think, in his 60s at this point when he publishes it. But he talks about wanting everybody to study everything. We have to get away from the world of the classics of Plato and whatever. This is a new world. And the new world is going to be one based on man's dominion over nature. And we, at the other end of that cycle that I'm saying, are aware that actually dominion over nature is not such a good idea. And we need to study it for other reasons. That is how to sort of try and sort of stop it from dying. And therefore, as I would say, we are entering a new age. But I don't quite know who the philosopher of the new age is going to be.
Yeah, who's the Genghis Khan who will bring in new ideas for us? Yeah,
yeah, it could be.
One last point about the contributions of nomads to our Western settled culture, for lack of a better term. I thought it was very interesting. You noted the way nomads learn to adapt and to be nimble and flexible in their thoughts and actions. How in trading over vast distances, steppe people knew how to organize themselves, were comfortable with the unfamiliar, could tolerate strange customs, and they found ways around indecipherable languages simply through the movement that they undertook constantly. It's sort of similar to some of the lessons we gain through travel.
Oh, absolutely. And the similar to the skills you require to be a comfortable traveler. And I think, there's so much reading back through nomad stories over the thousands of years, and my nomad's book starts at 9,500 BC, is, you see exactly the same thing. And that is when borders are open, when people are free to move and interact. When people are brave enough to look at each other without preconceived notions, then the world flourishes and you have the happy times, the great times of our human story, and the other times when there are walls, borders, anxiety, fear of the foreigner, well, we end up in war. Is what happens, as we are now. And I close the book with this beautiful poem from the Greek Alexandrian poet Constantine Cavafy, "Waiting for the Barbarians," because it's such an interesting thing, because as he says in this, and this was written in the 1910s, I think, certainly over 100 years ago, he writes, well, what's going to happen if the barbarians don't come? Those guys were some kind of solution. And I had that in my head the moment I decided I was going to write this book, because I think, I don't know how far, a philosopher, Gilles Deleuze, who writes about nomadic thought, nomadic thinking. And I don't agree with everything or even much of what he says, but I do absolutely agree with the idea that nomads are required to have multiple solutions to every situation. Not just plan A, but plan B. It's not like, what am I going to do today? It's, because the world that they live in is not one that they control. I mean, if you live in a city, you get up, you know when you turn on the tap, there'll be water. And, when you put on your coffee machine or your kettle or whatever, there'll be electricity. And these are certainties, and there are certainties the whole way through your day. But living as a nomad, there are not. And you have no idea what's going to attack your herd. You have no idea what disease might descend. You have no idea whether the sun will shine or it's going to be flooded or whatever. So, and those are the obvious things. There's all the other things you can't even predict are going to make problems for you in your day. And therefore, you are required to be absolutely nimble in your thoughts. I'm certain that this is something, A, that what makes a very good traveler. You set out with a plan you'd like to get from A to B, but actually you don't fall apart if you end up going in the opposite direction or going nowhere for that day. You find other things, you find beauty, you find people, you find fascination, you find whatever it is. But I also think that in this extraordinary and in a way, I think, unprecedented time that we find ourselves living in, that's exactly the quality we need, not preconceived, not everything mapped out, because clearly maps don't work anymore.
There's something very hardwired about that still deep in our psyche, I think, that calls to us. I mean, despite the hardships, you see people romanticizing sort of the nomadic alternative, like Chatwin and Blake as well, who look back at these people and see sort of an earlier and a purer way of life. Did you have access to Chatwin's famously failed nomad book, the manuscript?
Yes, I've read it.
Wow. So why did he fail and you succeeded? Do you think at this?
Well, I obviously succeeded because I read his. No, I was very excited when I realized I was going to be able to read it, because I'd obviously heard about it a long time, and I knew the story of it, and you know that this was his first book. That famously, the longer it went on, as his wife Elizabeth said, that obviously the worse it was going to be. And the more unhappy he became, and he would then say, I think I need to go off and travel with another group of nomads for a while. And it just went on and on. But it's a surprise. I mean, in one way, it's not a surprise because it's a first book. And first books tend to be, there's usually too much in them. And he has put down just about everything he knew about nomads. It's really clunky. But the real surprise is that it doesn't have the wit, the beauty, the stirring qualities of, for instance, his next book, In Patagonia, which is just an extraordinary piece of work. It's just, those are not there. And I think, I mean, it must have hurt him immensely, because, you know, it was commissioned by Tom Mashler, who was like one of the great literary editors of the time, on the basis of a letter that Chatwin had written, laying out this idea for a book that, you know, and if you did that today, well, for this book, I thought it would be quite witty to reference Chatwin, to write a letter to my editor in the Chatwin style. And I did. And the reply was, that's a really interesting idea. When are you going to write a proposal? So Chatwin, the book was bought, and then he had to sit down and write it, so it's full of really, it's sort of full of stuff. Some of it's really plodding, some of it's really interesting, but I thought I'd be quoting passages out of it, but I really don't, because there really isn't, and apparently, you know, it will never be published, and in a way it should never be published. And one reason why it shouldn't is that he took some passages out of that first book called The Nomadic Alternative and put them into the notebook section of the Songlines.
Yeah.
Because he knew he was ill at that stage, and it was had the sense of a last book, and it's a sort of summing up. So he's plundered Nomadic Alternative and his notes for it. For the Songlines.
So we did get some of the best of it in the Songlines.
So I think we see the Songlines as a second coming of the Nomadic Alternative.
Wow, that's good. I've always wondered about that. So I don't feel bad for not being able to read it now. So final question. Do today's digital nomads fit into the world you're describing? There's a lot of talk about digital nomads. And I guess in a sense, the pastures they're seeking involve things like warm weather and low taxes and easy visa requirements rather than lush grass and herd for animals. Is there a parallel?
There are parallels, and you've just named some of them, and a desire to move around. But today's digital nomads are obviously lacking one absolutely central feature, and perhaps the most important feature of all of traditional nomads, and that is a dependency on the natural world. And I think without it, there's a big gap to breach. It's not to say you couldn't, and I would love to see more and more digital nomads going out and engaging with the natural world and putting themselves at the mercy of the natural world. I think that would be a good thing to do. But certainly, you know, in as you say, in the sort of desire to move around, to communicate with other people, to see other places, to live lightly. Which is obviously one of the features. I mean, that's why I don't qualify. I never will as a nomad, because I travel around with literally tons of books. So that's just not, I'm just, you know, there's no caravan going to be big enough for my library.
So. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, you nailed the crucial distinction, because they're not, while they're seeking a life of barrier-free, sometimes constant movement, they're living in a virtual world that no matter where they are, it is kind of the same. They're living in this constructed world that's someplace else and not in the world that we inhabit now. And they're not drinking mare's milk.
And they're not. And Ibn Khaldun would definitely not approve, because, you know, because they're not going to have this quality that he sees as being the essential nomadic quality, and that is to be sort of hardened by the purity of your life in the desert.
Yeah, just softened by a latte instead. Yeah,
exactly.
Very interesting. So the book is called Nomads, The Wanderers Who Shaped Our World. And I really enjoyed this. It reminded me of my own kind of urge to travel and why it's so important and so fundamental, and why I need to tear myself away from my desk more often and get off my arse regardless of deadlines. So thank you, Anthony, for your time today and for that crucial reminder, an important one for us all, I think.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Personal Landscapes. If you like the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes and subscribe through your favorite app. You can find links to today's podcast and more conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdock.com. You'll also find a donate button if you'd like to contribute to the costs of the show. All donations are greatly appreciated.